This is Sustainable East End, a monthly series about how land use, water resources, energy, transportation, and food impact the environment of the Twin Forks of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The bird population is declining dramatically. The Audubon Society estimates that 3 billion birds have gone missing in North America in a generation. But there's something you can do about it. What you grow in your yard can make all the difference. Did you know that a chickadee needs 3,000 to 6,000 caterpillars to raise one nest of young to maturity? What happens if you've nuked your property with pesticides that kill all that vital bird food? Today, we talk with celebrated landscape designer Edwina Van Gaal about her new project, Two-Thirds for the Birds. It's all about gardening to meet the basic needs of the earth and the creatures we share it with. How? By planting two-thirds native species for every one-third of exotic plants. I visited Edwina at her magnificent gardens in East Hampton, New York, where she puts this principle into action. We are talking with Edwina Van Gaal at her beautiful gardens. What do you call these gardens?
My place is called Marsh House, and because I'm on a salt marsh, and so it's this incredible opportunity for me that I can garden from the salt water to the upland. So I have a huge number of different little ecosystems, and so that I can experiment with. And I'm a landscape designer and I'm an environmentalist, and so I'm kind of dedicated to making this place an example.
We're here to talk about your new project, Two-Thirds for the Birds. What is this project? Why did you start it?
Well, I've been running something called the Perfect Earth Project for a number of years now. I founded it in 2013. And as a landscape designer, I felt that I wanted to explore what I and my profession could do to make landscapes friendly to the environment. And I saw that landscape design was often working at odds with the environment, and people were designing landscapes and maintaining landscapes with a remarkably high degree of chemicals. And I have never used chemicals on my own gardens, and I thought, well, maybe this is something that I can do to contribute. An actionable item.
And when you're talking about two-thirds for the birds, you're not just talking about birds, but you're talking about what birds eat.
We're talking about biodiversity, really. So since the 1970s, we have lost about a third of our bird population, which is close to 3 billion birds, billion with a B.
Just in the U.S.?
That's North America, U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Or does Mexico count as North America? Anyway, so they say North America, because that's where our flyways are as well. So it counts all the migratory birds, which aren't permanently stationed necessarily in the U.S. But the largest losses have actually been in the more common birds, because those are the birds that are living where we live, and we don't share very well. So they're trying to maintain their habitat in places that we are now making inhospitable with our landscapes and our use of land that actually masses amounts of lawn and minimum amounts of native plants. So Doug Ptolemy did some research, and he discovered that a bird needs about 70% native plants in its range. And if that can be provided, the bird population could be stabilized and returned to its a healthy state. So that got me thinking that, okay, I've been talking about this like with Perfect Earth and talking about it, but I'm not really giving people some kind of a thing they can really grab onto. So I thought, well, this is it. This is a quantifiable, measurable action, which is if I plant two native plants, because 70%, I thought, that's about two-thirds, and that rhymes with birds. And the main problems for the bird decline, loss of habitat, use of pesticides. I said, that's totally my wheelhouse. You know, that's what I'm working on. So let's see if this doesn't resonate. because birds are the canary in the coal mine. People can identify with birds. People get passionate about birds a lot more than maybe a native plant. It's painful for me, but it's the truth. And so I thought, let's see how this works. And maybe first, I do a call to action to my own community, which is professional landscape design. Landscape architects, landscape designers. Can you, if you were given two basic rules, really easy, low bar, can you promise to do that and never ever thereby design a landscape again that doesn't meet the basic needs of the earth? And birds being therefore representative, birds are representing insects, birds are representing biodiversity, birds are representing the earth, because they're the, what would you would call a key indicator species. So when they're, because they're visible, and when their populations decline, it means that what they're eating is disappearing. A chickadee needs 3,000 to 6,000 caterpillars to raise one nest of young. And in one season, if it's going to maintain a healthy chickadee population, it generally raises 2 to 3 nests of young. So that means, and how far can they really travel to go get caterpillars and back to the nest, you know, before they, like, it doesn't work if they have to go too far. Not that far, less than 1/4 mile. So if your property and your neighbors in the immediate vicinity do not have about 18,000 caterpillars, you're not even getting one family of chickadees supported. And so if you see your oak tree or your favorite plant crawling with caterpillars, rejoice. Do not call the spray guy. That you are serving your chickadee population. The chickadees will take care of the caterpillars for you. I mean, just think of how many caterpillars they are eating. Baby birds do not eat seeds. Baby birds cannot eat nuts. They can't eat any of that. They need caterpillars. Caterpillars are filled with protein and keratin. Keratin is an important component of their diet in order for them to develop the color of their plumage, which is important for mating.
Wow, that is so interesting there. You know, recently I've been watching Richard Attenborough's World in Color, in which he talks about how birds see millions and millions, you know, they see many more colors than we do. And so that really shows the connection that if we're not feeding the birds so that they can develop the color that they need to, they can't breed.
It less successfully, because the males with the brightest plumage are the ones the females prefer, and it goes on. But also they can't even develop like strong, healthy bodies, because they need that protein. They need to be able to digest the food. And that's what moms are shoving down their little necks.
So, you know, what I can imagine, though, is somebody can say, okay, 2/3 for the birds and I'm going to plant them. What about the other part, the pesticides? Because from what I understand, the insect population globally is collapsing. And isn't that kind of the basis of the food chain?
Sure thing. It sure is. And that's what I mean. Like, the birds are indicators of another collapse, because they are dependent on the insects for their food. And a lot depends on insects. We don't think about it. What is E.O. Wilson called it? The little things that the whole world depends on, or something. He has a great quote about how important insects are, that everything depends on the insects. Well, and the insects depend on plants. So, but if we kill the insects, like everybody asks me about ticks. Okay, what do you mean? Because you see, if you are planting for pollinators, so you're planting your native plants, and that's, shrubs are really an important part of that. So like a whole, because then you get early and late season more so than plants, but I'm wandering here. But if you're planting for pollinators and then you spray your property, we'd rather you didn't plant for pollinators, because you're attracting pollinators and then you're spraying them. Because there is no such thing as a tick spray. Organic, non-organic, oregano oil, whatever you're using, unicorn oil, you know, it will kill all insects. Ticks are particularly hard to kill. It's a lot easier. Those sprays are not tick specific. And the permethrin is not made from marigolds or chrysanthemums, rather. You know, it is a synthetic and it is dangerous. And you can't kill. You cannot possibly kill every tick on your property. And if you did that, you would be really killing everything, you know, and because they'll just come right back. Mm-hmm. And so what all the tick disease specialists say, number one, there is zero evidence that spraying properties has reduced the incidence of Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. But what it has done is it has reduced the incidence of our fireflies and our butterflies and our bees. And all of our beloved, you know, beautiful pollinators, they are suffering really badly from this spraying. And so the key is spray yourself and check yourself. And one of the reasons they think that spraying properties has not shown any positive impact on disease incidence, they think it's because people stop being vigilant and they don't check themselves anymore because they think they've done it. Everybody wants a magic pill. I do too, you know, and yeah, you know, so yes, if I could just do one thing and not have to think about it anymore, wouldn't that be great? But I spray myself. I keep a bottle of spray right by my door and I go outside and I just spray from like my thighs down.
Edwina Van Gaal calls herself an activist, which for her means changing minds.
Activism is I'm trying to get people to change. So I'm trying to change the way people look at their relationship to a piece of land. And not even if you don't own a piece of land, surely there's a piece of land where you like to go and you feel peace there, or you know it somehow improves your day. And so your job and what I'm asking you to do is to do what you can to make sure that that piece of land is meeting the basic needs of the earth using birds as the indicator species. When you plant, are 2 out of every 3 of these plants natives? Do you use pesticides? And are you eradicating invasives? Because invasives kind of have to go. And so in many cases, because they outcompete the plants we want. So I'm just like, we draw the line on exotics. Yes, fine. 1/3 of your landscape, plant it up with exotics. Try not to do the ones that nothing will eat, which is what garden centers love to sell. Nothing will eat them. That tells you something, because there are exotic plants that do provide a lot of nectar and pollen and places and leaves to nibble. Just get the ones that have fertile flowers that do produce nectar and pollen, that do have nibbleable leaves, and that are not invasive.
So Edwina Van Gaal, as we are here, we are in the middle of these beautiful gardens. Can you point out to us some examples of the pollinator-friendly plants that you've planted here?
Sure. This side of the garden is the side where deer are, which is another whole conversation, because another thing that really needs to be addressed is the deer population, because deer are eating so many of our native wildflowers that the availability for pollinators to access wildflowers is becoming very limited.
In a future segment, we'll play more of our conversation with Edwina Van Gaal about deer-proof plants. But let's talk back to talking about planting to meet the basic needs of the earth. For example, Edwina mulches with plants, not with mulch.
Plants are social. So just think of a party, you know, and if people were all standing around a party looking like balls and rectangles, you wouldn't get the feeling that this was a good party, would you? No, you know, they're not partying. And to my mind, it should all be like this great mingling, post-COVID, hugging, embracing, touching. And that's what a garden really is meant to be. So what I do, if you can see this one, we're just putting all these plants in. It's completely, every space is filled. And what we do is take things from seed. I throw a lot of seed down. And even something that's not native, like sweet alyssum, which the deer won't eat, you can throw that seed down once you plant your bed, and it'll just fill in like crazy all between. If your space doesn't have deer, use Rudbeckia, like Rudbeckia hirta, which is the, is that brown-eyed Susan, I think, or black-eyed, one or the other. Anyway, the first year, you'll just get this incredible carpet of fuzzy leaves, just like tight. So that's like all of the weeds are smothered out because you get that in there first, and it covers the ground. The second year, it comes up and blooms. The third year, you'll have less. And then as the plants you planted grow in, it'll fade out. And people have always said, oh, I don't like Rudbeckias because it never lasts. Well, it's not really, that's not the plant it is. It's a pioneer. It's there to get things started. So if you disturb areas of your garden, then it can keep coming back. So you'd have to keep disturbing and making openings for it. But I'm fine with it disappearing over time.
This is Sustainable East End on WPKN Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with landscape designer Edwina Van Gaal about her new initiative, Two Thirds for the Birds.
This one is one of my really favorite plants. That's a cimicifuga.
A what?
It's a cimicifuga. And they're always changing the names in Latin, so now it's Actea, but I think it's called black cohosh, which there's nothing black about it. So, you know, go figure on that.
That's a medicinal herb.
Probably. And it's native. And the deer, it has these beautiful, tall, skinny racemes that go up and then tip over at the top. And so on into the winter, in the fall, you leave them up. Never cut your garden back in the fall. It's the home for everything. That's where do all these things go in the winter? To the ground, to the leaves, to the stems, everything. They're living at the base of everything. And your standing seed heads are what birds feast on all winter. All of those seeds. So they'll come and visit them, the birds that haven't left for the winter. And some of our insects migrate, like everybody knows about the monarchs, but many, many of them, and most of our bees don't leave. They're all here. They're all hunkered down. So they'll come down with the leaves. And if you're out there with a blower blasting the stuff away from under your trees, well, that's your moth and butterfly population. Completely.
How about mulching the leaves?
Oh, you can mulch mow. It does some damage to your resident populations, but in many cases it works well because I do a certain amount of mulch mowing and put the leaves back on especially my shrub beds, but I try to keep a good percentage of leaves intact.
But I don't see any leaves here on these lawns.
Oh, it blows away over the winter. Well, this grass area gets mowed. So it's all mulch mowed and it grows right back in the ground. We don't take anything away. It just mulch mow it and back in the soil, which is important. And ideally, and then we do leave stuff under the trees that just stays. And then at different times during the years, like we try to keep some that we don't mow every year, and some other we mow, like, so it's a rotation of what gets mowed. In any given year, we try to leave a third of the property not mowed, or of the meadow areas, so that there's a third of a population at least that isn't getting, and we don't cut until as late as possible. So the meadow out there, we just cut that last week. And it's even a bit early because you see the green isn't really showing that much. I just try to cut it. Most of the grasses in meadows in the Northeast are warm season grasses. So they're the kind that grow like humps. They're clump forming grasses. You don't want to shave that clump off. And most mowers can't be set high enough to miss them. So we do it with weed whackers. And we cut about 8 to 12 inches high. And then we remove that and make haystacks because you need to keep a meadow lean.
Wow, that's great.
So there's another one here is Amsonia hubrecti, which I think it's called Blue Star. The trouble with common names, and like I know it sounds like so off-putting to be always saying the Latin names, there are so many different common names for the plants that if you went and asked for this plant, they might not have it by that name. So if you're armed with the Latin name, you'll get the plant you're looking at, provided the garden center you go to is reasonably up to speed. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things, because people are saying, okay, I'm going to plant two natives for every three. Number one, how do I know what I've got now? And how do I know what to buy? Mm-hmm. So for what you've got now, I'm suggesting that you go to your local cooperative extension, join a garden club, make friends with the gardener, you know, or something like that. Ask around. You could even like get a group together in your neighborhood and bring someone in to say, let's just go from property to property and identify what we've got here. One of the first things to do to being a good steward of the earth is actually know the names of what's living with you. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a life or death kind of thing. And so if you don't even know their names and you don't know what they like, and it's like raising kids, like you should know them a little better than that if they're going to, right? Or unless you just hand them over to a nanny. And that's what people are doing. But they're handing them over to landscapers who don't know their names either. Right. And that's a real problem. So the first thing is that you are really in the end, like you're responsible. It's your property. So take responsibility and get to know a little bit about it.
So is there something else that you want to show me here?
Well, I would like to talk just briefly. It's part of the two-thirds thinking, which is that your entire property is an ecosystem. And if you think of it or as that, then what I like to do is consider the food chain or the food web. I call it the food loop. So that means that biomass and organic matter breaks down, goes into the soil. The soil then turns it into food for plants. The plants add more energy from the sun. The plants are the only thing on earth that can actually take energy from the sun and make something with it. So they then do that in the soil. They produce something, then something else eats it, then something else eats that, and then it goes back in the soil. So that's the food loop. And that's contained on earth. We have no other, everything we need is on earth. There's no other place to get it. And if you can't do that in your own property, like you have to keep buying fertilizers or buying stuff in to keep the plants on your property alive, then something's broken. There's a break in that link. So my thing is that everything your property made for itself, the food it made for itself, is your biomass. See if you can rise to this challenge, is none of it leaves the property. Our landfills are 20% landscape, what they call waste. There is nothing waste about it. That's the food your property made for itself. So when I say, would you consider going toxic free with your landscape or lawn? People say, great, what do I buy? I say, oh, well, I hate to tell you, but there's nothing to buy. Nothing. If it comes in a package, it's not really natural. I don't care. Even it says like organic on it. Nature doesn't need packaged goods. It's all here. It's all here already. The only time you might need to add some exterior inputs is for vegetables, because you are extracting. You're eating and you're not pooping it back in your garden. Whereas everything else on earth happens that way. You know, it gets the full circle. But you're removing that waste product and putting it someplace healthier.
But what if you see, like, I have a plant that is looking like a little reddish on some of the leaves, and I'm thinking it's missing something.
Well, one of the things is to really, that's like one of the basics of really being a good gardener is being able to read your plants and knowing what's wrong with it. So one of the things is right plant, right place. So if you choose all the plants in your property for the soil condition and the wind and the sun, it's going to have what it needs. Mm-hmm. So that's the way to do easy gardening. Because I used to be the gardener who wanted every new exotic foreign introduction that ever happened, and then was so proud of keeping them alive. And now I just want the plants that are happy to be here, that aren't begging for my help, that aren't patience. I don't want patience for plants. I want plants that are in their element, mm-hmm. and giving, like giving, just giving out to the pollinators. And so I don't know what your plant is with the red leaves. And so it could be that it's just not, it could be that it's not getting what it wants. Sometimes people think that a plant needs water when it's actually getting too much water. And so most people water terribly. Watering is a big mistake in most landscapes, which causes problems that then triggers the use of chemicals. Water seldom, water deep. Think of a rainfall. Don't water till it's dry. If it is now the middle, almost the middle of May, your irrigation system should not be running. So it should not be running until you leave a footprint in your lawn. That means it's dry. Anyway, back to how do you know? So that's really about knowing your plants, mm-hmm. just knowing your plants. Very seldom does a plant need like an input. If your pH is off, you can't change the pH of your entire property. Mm-hmm. If your pH is low, if your pH is really acid, well then plant acid loving plants. Mm-hmm. And there's so many of them. That's rhododendrons and azaleas. And so, you know, get that part right. And it doesn't, just because your soil is acidic in one part of your property doesn't mean it is in another, especially here in this is glacial, you know, terminal moraine. And so different chunks of New England are plopped all over Long Island. And some of it was topsoil and some of it isn't, you know, some of it's really acidic. Some of it was sand, and then you add a lot of forest stuff for years. And so that's another fun thing, is just getting to know your soil. Get your hands in your soil. In the process, you'll probably ingest a lot of it, and that's the best thing for your gut biome ever. And people pay a lot to, you know, for soil-based biome, yeah. You know, probiotics.
Well, Edwina Van Gaal, it has been such a privilege to walk your gardens with you and to learn so much information. I want to thank you so much. Is there any last minute, you know, where can people go? I assume we can go to twothirdsforthebirds.com.
Yes. It's 234birds.org. And in number one, we'd love you to sign up and just make the commitment to be a two-thirder. It doesn't matter where you stand in your gardening trajectory right now. You're just saying, from this day on, I'm going to give this a go. And we will not be visiting your property to you'll know in your heart if you're cheating or not. And on two-thirds to the birds, we have what's called access to tools. And that's really what the site is. It's a toolbox. Mm-hmm. And it's filled with ideas and filled with resources. It's probably the only website designed to send people to other people's websites, mm-hmm. but it is. And we want you to engage in this community. But by having your name in there, you're telling everybody this is, you're doing it, and it encourages other people. And hopefully you can look and see, maybe there's a landscaper in your community that signed up. And if you need someone, there might be a good place to find them. And they can find you, and you can create networks of learning about what a native plant is, how you're doing. This is sort of my gift to the community. It's not me doing it for you. It's you doing it for you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
You've been listening to Sustainable East End. I spoke with Edwina Van Gaal about her initiative, Two Thirds for the Birds. It's about planting two-thirds native plants for every one-third of exotics. More information about the project is available at 234birds.org. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday each month at this time, and also on the second Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. Programs are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.